Anybody on here?
Yep.
Okay, I just want to make sure I was in the right place.
Good afternoon. All right. Good afternoon. We'll call the meeting to order. And Jane, would you please take the roll?
Abramovich. Ken. I know Ken's here. Alexia.
You just got
Vladimir Alexia. Arendt. Anthony Arendt. Bates.
Yes.
Carrie Baker. June here. June Watabe for Carrie Baker. I know I saw him too. Bandopache.
Yes.
Barbosa.
On audio.
Okay, thank you. Bret Hart.
Here.
Brown.
Here on audio.
Okay, Steve Brown's on audio. Kathy's not here today. Travel. Davis?
Here.
Richard CF on the screen, Mike. Fallon?
Here.
George Bettisworth?
Come on, audio.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Golux?
Here.
Gustafson?
Here.
Healy?
Here.
Henry?
Here.
Emma Bloom?
On audio, here.
Okay. Horsemond?
Yep.
Jensen?
Here.
Johnston?
Here.
Jolie?
Here.
Jones?
Here.
Marden? here for Cecile Larden? Lawler?
Here.
Mathis?
I'm here on audio.
McCackern?
Here.
Metzger? Anyone here for Andrew Metzger? Mayer or Meyer?
Here.
Moses? Cindy Hardy for Deborah Moses. Nadine?
Here.
Newberry? Inga? Chung Sang?
Here.
Radenbaugh?
Right here.
I see ya. Rennis?
Here.
Reynolds?
Here.
Short?
Here.
Valentine?
Here.
Weber?
Here.
Winfrey?
Here.
Zhang? Okay. Acknowledge our ex officio members, Melanie Arthur?
Here.
Mike Ernest?
Here.
Anyone here from ASUF? Looks like we have Robert Kennard. Dean Lair?
Here.
Associate Dean Hartman? We have our Chancellor Rogers. Provost Kendrick. Dana Thomas. And I know I saw Eric Manson and our past president, John Dean.
All right, Kathy Cahill is on travel today. She's in Japan, so I will be running the meeting. The minutes to our previous meeting, number 180, were posted online this past weekend. Do we have a motion to approve the minutes? Are there any changes to them? Are there any amendments to those minutes? I hear a motion to approve. Do I hear a second?
Second.
All right. And then the agenda for today's meeting you have in front of you. I have a request to change the order of two of the items under new business. The request is to move item F up to the third in line. So we would do A, B, F, and then C. Is there any discussion of this change? Any other changes requested? All right, do I hear a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
Second? All right, the agenda is approved. From our previous meeting, the Chancellor has approved the motion to define the academic credit hour requirements for laboratory instruction. There are no other motions pending. And as Kathy's not here today, I will cover the topics that she normally would. The first is the listening sessions for the strategic directions effort by the statewide office. During the month of February, there were 5, 6 listening sessions held at different UAF campuses, including this main campus, but also the Interior Aleutians campus, the Community and Technical College, Kuskokwim campus, Northwest, and Chukchi campuses. Those have now been completed for the UAF campuses. There are several other listening sessions scheduled, but they are for statewide offices and UAA. I hope you all were able to participate in the faculty sessions for your own campuses. If not, and if you have any other additional comments, you're encouraged to send them in through the web form that is published on the statewide website. The second topic is the eLab Task Force. This is the task force set up by the Faculty Alliance to look at delivery of science labs by distance delivery. And this task force has completed their recommended policy, a draft of this policy. That draft will be distributed to all members of the Faculty Senate today, as well as the deans and directors and department chairs. We're distributing it for input, feedback. The intent is that this draft, if feedback is positive, will come to the Faculty Senate for consideration as to whether this should be adopted as UAF policy. So when you see this come in your email, please do take a close look at it. Encourage those in your department to take a close look at it. This would be a substantial change from the present practices. The recommended policy is directed at science labs, but those of you who are in departments that run labs outside of science courses should also look at it, because this may end up being a policy that is adapted to a broader range of labs in the future. We'd like to know your thoughts on this as well. And the third topic is the Faculty Alliance has not yet addressed the Stay on Track and Complete America efforts. That is now the top priority for the Faculty Alliance now that the ELAB Task Force has been passed on to the three faculty senates. So I hope we will be able to tell you more about that in our next meeting. Are there any questions to me? Good. And next in line is our chancellor.
Well, good afternoon, and I appreciate, again, as always, the opportunity to have a few minutes with the Senate. Spent most of the last week in Juneau working on budget-related issues, and I want to report a little bit about that and then briefly touch on a couple of other items. Generally, the mood in Juneau was positive toward the university. I think our budget request on the operating side was the smallest increase that we've asked for in years, and in fact surprised some of the long-term staff there at how much we brought that down. And in particular, where they had asked us last year to come up with non-state funds for at least half of what we were asking for, they were surprised that we actually came up with more than half in non-state funds. The good news is they think we should be rewarded for that, and while the first budget will be out of the House Finance Committee, the subcommittee is basically forwarding the governor's request on to the full committee, but it's because essentially the subcommittee is the full committee. In full committee, an amendment will be offered by the chair that has all of our academic advising increment that we requested, our top priority, in it. Also, funding for the engineering, College of Engineering and Mines, about $400,000 there, and items for the other two institutions as well, probably in the order of $2.5 to $3 million increase. And considering that all the governor had was essentially our fixed half of our pay raises, that's a substantially better than what we saw out of the governor. I expect a couple of other amendments will be offered on other specific operating increments. Not as sure what the likelihood is that those will be adopted, but everyone down there was feeling pretty positive about those. The Senate expects to add to the House request for us, so some of the other items that were included that have specific constituencies, I expect we'll see some programmatic growth in our budget. So, again, overall, fairly positive. Really nothing on the capital budget side at this point. Early in the process, most of the action will happen between now and your next meeting on operating. Essentially, all of it will happen, and then the capital, probably the first couple weeks of April, will be when we see significant action. One significant item of concern on Friday, The House Finance Committee took up a supplemental appropriation bill, which included funding for all legal claims against the state. Included in that was the proposed settlement between the university and plaintiffs over the optional retirement plan, that I know a number of people in this room are affected by that. The House Finance Committee declined to essentially pull the money out of what they're calling the fast track supplemental. So as of today, they basically are splitting what they saw as the non-controversial items going in a fast track and anything that had any controversy into what they're calling the, quote, flow track. And so I anticipate going back to Juneau next week to work on that specific issue. We have to get an appropriation out of the legislature this year to fund the settlement agreed to by the union and the university. And the fact that they pulled it out is causing us some concern. What the likelihood of action is at this point, I'll know better next week how that sits. A couple of other items real quickly. Jennifer touched on the President's SDI, the Strategic Directions Initiative. I listened to the tape of the faculty listening session that was held here at the Fairbanks campus, and there was one item raised at the end of the meeting. I'm not sure who raised it, but a concern raised over the smart classrooms and what was the status of spending on the smart classrooms. And it is true that we were not able to spend all of the money that was set aside last year at the beginning of this year for smart classrooms, and it was because they couldn't have all the classrooms ready for the beginning of the school year and didn't want to have construction going on during the school year. But it's also the case that that money still is sequestered and ready to be spent. So the remaining funds of the $1 million that I reported to you last year will all be spent on smart classrooms, albeit on a slower schedule. And I don't know who it was that raised the issue, but I can provide background, further background from OIT and facilities on the schedule and what else gets covered for anyone who would like that. And with that, I'll stop and can answer any questions that members of the faculty senate might have.
Any questions for Chancellor Rogers?
I'm just curious, on the listening session, are there posting so that we can kind of see what topics have been brought up?
I don't know the answer on whether they're posting. They do a summary of each one, and I've received from that office summaries of those that were held in the public sessions last fall. I haven't seen any from the internal sessions, but because there was a concern raised about an issue brought up at the faculty, the UA faculty one, I asked for and got a tape so I could listen and hear the issues as well.
In fact, the answer is no, they're not posting summaries. What they are posting is a selection of some of the comments, and these are shown in the newsletters that are on the Strategic Directions website. So if you click on one of the newsletters, on the right side, you'll see a series of comments, but those are samples of what was said in the meeting. Dave.
With respect to the ORP settlement, if the legislature does agree to it, then clearly we're done. But if they do not, is the agreement thrown out, or what then happens?
I'm not a lawyer, and I would not want to speculate on what either party might do. I just want to make sure that we don't get to that bridge. It's important to me that we get funding for the settlement.
The statement from the union's lawyers during the meetings that we had last winter was that if the legislature does not pass this appropriation, then the lawsuit resumes. Any other questions? All right. Next, Provost Hendrick.
First, a very quick report on the Board of Regents meeting that occurred several weeks ago. It wasn't a particularly eventful meeting, which by and large is good news. There was, in academic affairs, the baking and pastry certificate that you approved a while ago was approved by the regents, and so that's going forward. Another thing that was discussed was program review at the three universities. The regents may remain very interested in the three universities maintaining a diligent and frequent program review process. They also are quite interested in going back to the degrees and certificates that have been approved in the past 5 years and seeing how those panned out. So there probably will be in the not-too-distant future for those you who may be responsible for a new degree or certificate program, a request for updated information. The other thing that I was asked to address quickly here is the outcomes of our program review process last year and this year in terms of what is happening relative to programs that were recommended for discontinuation. And that information is included in a letter that went out with the program reviews that are being sent to programs. But to summarize quickly, a program that's recommended for discontinuation first has an opportunity to appeal. Appeals will be considered by the Chancellor's Cabinet if an appeal is filed. If an appeal is not filed, then the program is expected to take the steps that are needed to discontinue. If there are no students enrolled in the program, and that applies to a few of the programs that were recommended for discontinuation, then they can file the Senate paperwork to eliminate the program right away. However, if there are students in the program, then we need to teach out those students and give them an opportunity to complete the degree. So the program will have its admissions suspended, and the program needs to communicate through me to the registrar in order to accomplish that. But then the students in the program can continue and will have an opportunity to complete within a reasonable time frame. And so only after the last student is finished or it's apparent that the last student isn't going to finish, then the program would move to formal elimination. The programs that are being recommended for discontinuation are essentially all programs that are only one of several offered by a department. So a department might have several baccalaureates and several master's degrees, and one of the master's degrees or one of the baccalaureate degrees or one of two are being recommended for elimination. So it's not as if entire departments or entire areas are being eliminated under this program review process. So I'll conclude my remarks there. Are there any questions? No questions for the provost? All right, on to our vice provost, Dana Thomas.
Thank you. I've worked with a number of the committees on some of the presentations later, and I'll speak up when those come up. If given the opportunity by the Senate, I'd be happy to respond to questions on those things, the need for them as we get there. Continue to work with the Accreditation Steering Committee on refining the themes, objectives, and indicators, and that work will continue for some time. One of the things that we have to move fairly quickly on, I brought it up to you last time, is revision of the mission statement. And the approach that we've decided to take is to put out a survey, send it out broadly, post probably four versions of draft mission statements, and not just ask for your favorite, but ask you to scale them on a 1 to 10, right? And then after each one, say if you could change something or if you feel strongly that something in this needs to be changed, what change needs to occur to that one? And through that feedback, we believe we can get the information we need to come up with a reasonable mission statement revision. So please watch for that and encourage your peers to take part in that. The other thing I'd like to let you know is the core revitalization work continues. The General Ed Revitalization Committee, several in here serve on that committee. Alexandra Fitz just returned from a conference on this material. She chairs that committee. In addition, my office is supporting a group of five to go to a Gen Ed Institute in June to continue that work, you know, and keep the understanding and the level at a national level, what else is happening nationally. And we hope to have, last I heard that group hopes to have a motion to you on a revised Gen Ed or revised core late this fall. So with that, I'll stop and wait till we get to other issues. Any questions for me?
No questions for Dana? No? All right, you'll have other chances because some of his topics will come up during our business section. So moving on to new business. New business number A. Call for nominations for the President-elect of the Faculty Senate for next academic year. The nominations are now open. They will remain open until our next meeting in April. The vote will take place at the next meeting. And you need to be in attendance at the next meeting. There will be discussion at the next meeting, ideally, about the nominees, and we will hold the vote then. Nominations are now open. Would anyone like to nominate someone at this time? All right, the process is simple. There, you need, after this meeting, between this meeting and the next, you simply need to send a short statement to the Faculty Senate office stating who you are nominating. You are welcome to nominate yourself. In fact, that is actually the norm, that people who are elected have put themselves forward, and that's good because then we know they're truly interested. So it's not a mark against you if you nominate yourself. And then we will ask for a short statement from each nominee that will be distributed to the Faculty Senate in advance of the vote. All right? And you're welcome to ask any questions of the Faculty Senate office or Kathy Cahill or myself. Any comments? All right, move on. New business B, motion to amend the Bachelor of Arts and Bachelor of Science degree requirements submitted by the Curricular Affairs Committee. Reiner.
This looks more complicated than it really is. Effectively, it's a request to permit a limited amount of double counting. It's especially appropriate to the Bachelor of Arts degree, and in particular to use of essentially excess, if you will, credits in a major to count towards the 18 credits of social sciences / humanities requirement. We attempted to pass this several years ago, and there were concerns among CLA faculty that maybe this wasn't a good idea. In the interim, and in particular in the last couple of weeks, virtually everyone in CLA who has been asked has thought that this was a great idea, and I urge you to vote yes on it.
A discussion of this amendment, of this motion.
Hi, I'm Linda Hapsmith from the Academic Advising Center. Basically, in advising, we've been doing things a certain way that went against the policy for about 20-odd years or so. But one thing I just want to make very clear is that this new policy, this new resolution, does not bring it back to how we were originally doing it. It's more of a hybrid between how we used to advise and what the policy said in the previous policy. And so I just want to be clear that we are only counting credits beyond a certain point within the major in the discipline and beyond a certain point in the minor in the discipline. Right, so you won't be able to count, let's say, all psychology credits for the major and for the social science requirement for the Bachelor of Arts. You can only use so many credits beyond the first 30 credits in psychology for the Bachelor of Arts requirements for the Bachelor of Science as an example. Okay. So I just want to make that clear, that this does not bring it back to advising per usual. It will be a little bit different, so it's going to take some getting used to.
Jane.
So is this going to be lined out in the advisor's manual?
Well, it's going to be on degree work.
Okay.
For all the degrees for this upcoming catalog year forward. Right? So this goes into effect fall.
It's really intended to, this is Mike Ernest, to level the playing field for people in those majors and minors where they might actually be required to take more credits than the minimum. So for psychology, they're taking 36 credits in psych, and if they're also an art minor, they're taking 19 credits in art. Well, they're already being required basically to do 129 credits for a BA if they don't get to count any of those credits toward the humanities. So it's really a fairly small number of students, but for those students, it's a significant change.
Any other questions or discussion? All right. Someone, do you have a motion to vote?
Call the question.
Call the question. Any second?
Second.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Any abstentions? All right. Motion is unanimous. Approval. All right. Moving on. We're going to go to item F under new business. This is attachment 181/5. This is a motion to approve a new directed study category registration submitted by Curricular Affairs Committee. Rainer, would you please guide us through this motion?
This, I think, is a truly great idea, and I wished I had thought of it myself. Basically, many faculty at UAF have been using the individual study mechanism for teaching a class to one or two students which couldn't make registration for a variety of reasons otherwise. And this causes difficulties because then this class has to be, the registrar's office has to know that this is actually a class and not merely some variety of individual study. And it never really shows up on the transcript as being equivalent to that class. It requires petitions to get the registrar's office on board with it. And anyone from outside the university looking at this has no idea what it is. The idea behind this motion is to create a separate category which is broadly like individual study, in as much as it will require a form filled out by the student and signed by the instructor and signed by the dean and possibly the dean's mother, but we're not quite clear on that part yet. That will say, not only are we doing this, but also will say, and this is effectively equivalent to course X. And they'll appear on the transcript as being effectively equivalent to course X, and the registrar's office will know that it's effectively equivalent to course X, and an outside person looking in at the university at the transcript will recognize it's essentially course X. I urge you to support this.
Yes, Dana.
A small addition, it'll also show up in degree works as counting to fulfill that requirement.
Any discussion of this motion?
I actually have kind of a question about this. I teach in the math and statistics department, and I've had students come to me and say, I want to take such and such a course, but it doesn't really fit into my schedule so well. Can I do it as an independent study? And I've turned them away and told them, basically, there's a reason why there are course numbers and why it's kind of scheduled the way it is. It takes so much more time for me to teach one student or two students a class outside of the regularly scheduled class. Why does this sort of thing go on? I mean, I didn't know that anybody else did it, and now I'm kind of wondering if it's going to be harder for me to turn down people who want to do it this way. And it's really hard for me as an instructor.
There really is no intention to put pressure on anybody to offer this. It strictly is it's between the instructor and the department chairperson and or dean, because clearly it's going to add to the workload. And probably, and this is the reason for having a dean sign off on it, is because it will add to the workload if a faculty member does undertake this. The idea is not to make it easier for students to pressure faculty into offering such, but rather, if for whatever circumstances a course is offered in this mechanism, it's much easier for everybody concerned to see that it is. One reason why this might happen, for example, is that, oh gosh, the course happens every other year or every third year, and it needs to be offered for one student. Well, what the hell, or three students. Oh well. Yes, it's not the most efficient way in the world to run things, but it does happen.
If I may?
Yes, who's online, please?
Yeah, this is Todd, and I just want to agree with what Raynor just said, because especially the rural campuses, we often have a student or two that, a course was never offered in rural campuses, and they need it for their degree, and being able to have something like this would be beneficial, no matter where the student was going to take the class.
Paul, did you have a comment?
I just had a question about the transcript. So on the transcript, if the student takes Math 200 through this mechanism, will it say Math 200, or will it have a designator that this was somehow DS, or will the transcript be blind to it?
Math 200, colon, comma, name your punctuation mark, DS.
Okay.
So Math 200 and DS.
So we'll amend the title to indicate that it was a directed study. But by having the same subject and course number, it'll feed into degree works properly.
So I think that in terms of, let's say, transfer credits from this university to another, I'm not convinced that, like, I've seen this so many times, students trying to transfer credits and, like, adding a DS thing, I feel like another university is going to look at it and have the same problem that they do now with individual study, because, well, there's something at the end, and that makes it not equivalent to, you know, just the Math 200 or something.
This explains what it is. I mean, admittedly, it's up to the instructor to teach the course in a manner equivalent to the way it would be taught to a larger group of people, but that's always the case. I mean, we don't have faculty, for better or worse, going around and checking up on other faculty to make sure that their courses are taught according to specs.
Yeah, I guess I'm just saying I'm not convinced that specifically for transfer credit it's going to make it any easier for the student to directly transfer to another place, because it'll be up to that other place to accept it or not.
Sounds like an interesting experiment, doesn't it?
I think largely they will, because we can answer the question if they ask. The content is exactly the same as Math 200X in the catalog, as opposed to having to provide to them a copy of the syllabus and what the text was and all of that. And a large percentage of the current individual study classes, I don't know the exact percentage, but it's over 70%, they are actually courses that exist in the catalog, and their instructors agreeing to teach a one-on-one section with the student.
Hmm. Dave, Valentine.
So I just wanted to emphasize a point that you just made, Mike, which is that this is not to take the place of any existing courses. It's to take the place of individual studies, just to make those clearer. So this can only be a step in the right direction as far as transfer credits are concerned.
Linda.
Linda, again, from the Academic Advising Center. What this also does is this helps eliminate a number of petitions that go through for these individual studies to have them count towards the major or count towards a certain requirement because they were set up to be the equivalent of an already existing course. And so it will alleviate, a number of those petitions going to the various committees. Yes, Ken.
That was really the question I was having. So the typical process would be for an independent study to go through a petition process to ensure that you had equivalency. Is there a similar process, or does this essentially put the full petition process in the hands of an instructor that would choose to offer a course like this?
We have yet to agree on the final version of the form that the faculty member would fill out, but somewhere in there would be the statement that by offering this in this fashion, the instructor is alleging, guaranteeing, affirming that the course will be essentially offered as it would be for a larger group. And then they would then sign it, and then we take their children hostage, and life would go on as usual.
Yes, Steve.
Yes, so I've offered a number of independent study classes which don't fall into this rubric. They are, in fact, independent studies. And typically my experience of that is that the way in which they're viewed in terms of workload and subsequent credit to the faculty member is that they're a little bit lightweight compared to what a normal course would be, and that seems appropriate. The question would be, if you were to undertake this, is there a different mechanism for how the faculty member would be somehow credited in terms of their workload, and is that something that needs to be part of the policy that's inherent in the motion?
Was that discussed in the committee, Rainer?
Yep. And we thought that could be put off to a later time. Our objective is to get this approved today, if in fact we can get this approved today, so it can go into the catalog and be official for next year. We have two more faculty senate meetings that we can devote to discussions of exactly how to deal with the issues of workload assignment that this brings up.
Yes, Susan. If we're going to have a university-wide or a UAF-wide policy on that, that actually is a matter for the collective bargaining agreement. There's basically two routes that we can go for workload. One is the substantive academic judgment of the dean, which means that we can't have a universal policy. And then the other is an agreement that's reflected in the CBA or a memorandum of agreement added on to the CBA. So we really do need to leave that question aside for later, I believe. Other comments or discussion? Yes.
I think it would be more useful in the graduate program. Oftentimes we don't have 5 or 6 students to teach a graduate class, and this one basically gives us the opportunity to teach them to study. It's not much an issue in the undergraduate program, but very, very helpful in the graduate program.
Last thing, is there any restriction on what faculty can teach what DS courses? Or is that simply whatever the faculty choose to undertake?
You need to be qualified to teach a class, right? So if you have expertise in multiple areas, go ahead.
Well, I guess that's where my petition process concern came in, was that if it gets around the petition process, is there anything to stop faculty from simply agreeing to teach courses that they choose to teach?
Do you have a comment on that, Dana?
I do. So I guess I'll remind you, it takes department chair and dean signature, much as a petition would.
Oh, does it? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Or it will. We have yet to actually design all the nuts and bolts on the form, but it will.
That's great.
Melanie?
Are you saying that it takes that because it has to go on the workload, or...?
For a number of reasons, one of which is that you want to have the department chairperson, for example, is going to be ultimately responsible that the person teaching the course is actually qualified to teach the course.
Yeah, so for instance, one of the things that comes up is the course is being offered. It doesn't fit that student's particular time, but it's available the next semester, and it would fit their time. The department chair can say, no, I don't see a need for this to happen this semester. They can take it. You know, it's not going to slow their progress. You know, it becomes an informed consent, if you will.
Yes.
So just to clarify, I mean, the professor would be teaching the class that they normally would teach and are qualified to teach, right? But there's a student or maybe two or three that can't meet at the scheduled time, and you're just accommodating them, right? So it's not like you're making up a new class that you're teaching and calling directed study.
Correct. You would not be able to use this for that situation, for making up a new class.
Yes.
This is for established classes. Anyone else? Yes.
Well, just briefly, I've done independent study courses before, but only for 1 hour or one credit, because that's kind of the time I have, and usually it's a kind of directed question that's appropriate for. Is there a reasonable expectation that if it were a three-credit class that the students would be receiving 3 contact hours with the instructor?
Yes, and it would be specified on the form that's what's going on. And again, it would be signed off by everybody as, yes, we agree to this. Anyone? Yes.
Yeah, sorry, one last thing. But we would also still be eligible to say no if we didn't. Okay.
And your department chairperson could say no for you and be the bad guy.
Which can be helpful.
Yeah.
And if I may, by asking for this, we're certainly not advocating that it be done more often. It's really just taking those directed studies that are now actually courses that exist in the catalog and changing those from a 9-7 designator to the actual course number that it really is. So, you know, we're not encouraging, asking, you know, wanting people to do more of these kinds of one-on-one courses. It's just, if you agree to do this with a student, this is the method by which you can do it so that the advising and the degree audit work better. If it's not a course that exists in the catalog, then the current individual study matches that.
Yep, my impression is that there's not a mechanism in this motion that makes it easier to teach this sort of course or to put this sort of course in a student's schedule. It's just what it changes is the means of reporting the course in the student's transcript and ideally clarifying what the faculty member is actually doing in their workload, et cetera. Anything else? Someone call the question?
Call the question.
And I heard a second one. All right. All those in favor of this motion signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. All those say, okay, thank you. All those saying opposed say nay. Any abstentions?
Abstain.
One, two, three abstentions. Four abstentions. Five. Five abstentions. All right, the motion carries. On to item C in your agenda, the motion to amend the educational effectiveness policy. This is submitted by the Curricular Affairs Committee also.
We brought this up last meeting to your attention. You think about it. Basically, we need to do this. Basically, we need to do this.
I support it.
All right, and the primary change in this motion is to require reporting every 2 years on student outcomes, educational effectiveness from the programs. Is there discussion on this motion? No discussion, no comments? All right, let's vote. Someone call the question?
So called.
All right. All those in favor, say aye.
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 All those opposed, say nay. Any abstentions? All right, motion carries unanimously. All right, on to item D, motion to approve an updated procedure for the program review process. This is submitted by the Administrative Committee, and on behalf of the Administrative Committee, Dana Thomas, would you please outline what this is?
Thank you. So you may recall, fall 2010, some of you were on the Senate then, I came to the Senate with a proposal for a revised program review process. That was a significant change from the previous process. We better aligned our process, the new process, with Board of Regents policy on program review. The previous approach wasn't following board policy very carefully. So that was the primary change. In that, at the same time, we asked, the provost and I, being we, asked that we move to a 3-year schedule of program review so that we could have two full cycles of program review during every 7-year accreditation cycle. The Senate balked at that change, and so we have fallen back to a 5-year cycle, and which is the Board of Regents policy, and so we would just go back to that. And then I've provided a great deal of detail of and revised formatting, what the evaluation form looks like, all of that. Those are on the table back there if you haven't received those. Just to make the reporting mechanism for programs and the evaluation line better, that was one of the comments we had from the program review teams that we had working last year. So I suppose the principal change here is the set of questions we're using, which follow Board of Regents policy, and the evaluation form, and going back to a five-year cycle. So.
Dana, is it fair to say that this is an evolution of the questions and methods used in the current year, and otherwise takes the process that has been used in the current year and makes it permanent, the permanent process?
Yes. We took a lot of input from the faculty committee in program review and the administrative committee in program review and the chancellor's cabinet, and implemented their suggested changes, and so it really was an evolution. I appreciate the use of that word in this case, from what was originally submitted in the fall of 2010. Much cleaner.
Any discussion on this motion?
Several members here served on the faculty program review committees. So,
hopefully by now you have all had a chance to discuss how the program review went with your own departments. One more chance. Any comments or discussion on this motion? All right. Then let's vote on the motion. All those in favor of approving this motion signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, aye. Say nay. Any abstentions? Carries unanimously.
Thank you.
All right, number E in your list, the motion to clarify the academic honors policy. Submitted by Curricular Affairs Committee. Yes, Brian, would you explain this, please?
This one is actually straightforward. We want to change and to or, with the idea being clear that a student will either make the chancellor's list or the dean's list, but not both.
Very, very straightforward. Any questions or discussion on this?
All the questions.
All right. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. Any abstentions? Motion carries unanimously. Number F, motion to approve and, oh, we did that one. All right, great. Number G, motion to amend the Student Academic Development and Achievement Committee's definition in the Faculty Senate bylaws, submitted by the Student Academic Development and Achievement Committee. Cindy Hardy here?
Yep. Yes. This is basically a housekeeping motion just to update things like changing the name from Tanana Valley Campus to CTC, but also it gave us a chance to kind of look at our rather large committee membership. So we just encourage you to approve it.
Does it change the membership on the committee?
We changed, we added the words at large to representatives from the College of Natural Sciences and Mathematics at the request of those members, because that's apparently how the process is being done. And then we also removed a line at the end of the definition. It seemed a little redundant and confusing, so we tried to clarify it. But it does not change the most. I was hoping it would reduce it somewhat, but we ended up not doing that.
Any discussion of this motion? No? All right. All those in favor, say aye.
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 All those opposed, say nay. Any abstentions? Our motion carries unanimously. And we are now at our break. Slightly early, but not bad. So we will break for 10 minutes. Please be back here at 2:05.
So Ron and I have done that quite a few times.
I'm really glad that it was good. Back.
Right.
Guest speaker. Guest speaker today is a tag team of Dana Thomas and Eric Madsen, who will be speaking to us on the efforts to set up an electronic annual activity reporting software for faculty. You have a handout on this. If you don't, there are copies in the back of the room. And I turn it over to Dana.
Thank you. Eric Madsen and I have worked with Faculty Affairs to see if we could find a software package that could fulfill our needs for electronic faculty activity reporting. My primary motivation for this is to be able to quickly and efficiently gather information that's useful in accreditation. Just that simple. And that applies to both institutional accreditation and specialized accreditation. But also a number of sort of regularly required state reports and sometimes ad hoc reports. We get requests all the time from the Board of Regents for certain information, and you get the idea. Currently, we have to make multiple requests to individual faculty for such information. One of my favorite stories, Anita Hartman won't appreciate it, but to gather the information that was needed on performances in CLA, she quite literally went hand one at a time through the activity reports of individual CLA faculty for the accreditation report. We just don't want to have to do stuff like that. That's disturbing that we have to do stuff like that. So we just started looking for alternatives. I guess I'll remind the Senate that we looked at, I should say, UA Statewide purchased a package for us some years ago, encouraged us to take part, and the Senate wasn't happy with that particular package at that time. It has changed substantially since. I'll inform you of that. But we thought after several years it was worth reexamining this. So we arranged with Faculty Affairs for demonstrations of four products after doing a search on our own, largely led by Eric, and he can speak to you about the search that he did to find these four products. One was FolioTech, one was TaskStream, another was Data 180, and the last one was Digital Measures, and their product is called Activity Insight. Members of Faculty Affairs attended those sessions that they could, and I'll be calling on Ken in particular, and perhaps John Dean, who came to several of those, but others are welcome to chime in that attended. But we quickly eliminated two of them. One was FolioTech and the other was TaskStream. They just didn't offer a product that looked like it fit with what our expectations were for faculty activity reporting, just that's plain. They were both adopted from another kind of software and trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. So Folio Tech was really about creating student portfolios, and they tried to jam it into a faculty portfolio for review for P&T. You have available a very nice side-by-side summary that Eric Madsen created with input from the two vendors that we think are worth considering. And you'll see on the very last page, in fact, the price comparison. OIT has been asked to pursue security elements in discussions with these two, and they have done, I think they've just about completed that work, but it didn't fully make this report. They just were finishing it up. So a little bit more information to be added to this and made available to you on OIT's assessment of this data security. All right. What I'd really like to do is from here forward is twofold. What one is talk to you about how to move the process forward in the consideration, and the other is to hear from those that were in attendance, other faculty members, on their perspectives on these. So that you've at least heard some opinions on these from your peers, all right? To move the process forward, I'm going to urge you to consider a one-hour presentation from each of these two software companies, and to do it, if we can, right after a Senate meeting. The reason for that is we really want broad buy-in into these. We don't want you to agree to something that just a handful of people said they thought was the best choice. So that's what I would like to see for a process, but I'm open to conversation on that. With that, I'd like to invite Eric to chime in on anything you think I may have missed.
Thank you, Dana. I think you covered all of the points that I would have mentioned. I would just like to say thank you to the many of you who made time in your schedules to visit with me. I started by going around and asking people who either had been involved in the process earlier or had expressed some reservations about it or some support for it, either one, people who were familiar with software and how it's written, and a lot of you were very generous with your time in making suggestions about how to proceed, so that's where that got started. I might, if Dana will allow me, I might go so far as to suggest that if we do presentations, we maybe even consider something a little bit longer than 60 minutes. Inevitably, after the vendors make their presentations, we saw it in some of the ones that we saw already, there were a lot of questions. So that's the important part, where you get to ask your questions and ask them to fill in holes that you're perceiving. So that might be a consideration also.
Eric, could I ask you or Dana to outline what criteria you were using to select software and what you think are the major features and differences here?
The criteria actually were pretty simple. Those that were offering themselves as doing that kind of thing, there aren't that many. As Dana mentioned, the first two, Folio Tech and TaskStream, may remember a couple of years ago that education went through this period of being interested in what was called authentic assessment, and portfolios were one of those alternate means. And it was pretty clear that the two of those products were designed for that purpose. And then, as Dana said, they tried to put a different wrapper on it, put a different colored ribbon. So that became clear very quickly. And then the two remaining ones that offer themselves as addressing that we were looking for, we scheduled longer presentations. Is that responding to what you're asking?
Somewhat. What I was thinking of was in a slightly different direction. The earlier effort with the digital measures software was trying to fill two needs at once. And my impression is that's still the case, although it might be more successful this time. And those two needs were the university's need for information for reporting in various ways.
Yep.
And the faculty's need to do faculty activity reporting for assessment
for
faculty performance evaluation, exactly. And those two are actually different activities with different types of information needs, and the people who should have access to each of those would be different. And so it, yep. it was not completely straightforward to adopt a single software package that would do both well. And so what I was thinking of was that general statement, that you're trying to do two functions at the same time with the software, and both need to work well.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. One of my interests in this, I served as dean of the School of Education for 7 years, and I just absolutely hated going back and asking people for information that was either redundant or appeared to be very similar. For example, for our annual unit plan, we report public units on a calendar year, if I recall. The legislature sometimes wants it on a fiscal year. Federal reports have their different years. So if you don't have that in front of you, then the best way to get it is to go back and say, you know, I really apologize for this, but could you send it again and this time period? That's a terrible waste of everyone's time.
So Jennifer, yes, there are two functions. We pursued those in these conversations with the software companies. Both allow you to apply who has access and who does not, okay? And it can be filtered at different levels. Reporting is typically, in other words, if you allow somebody to generate reports, you get aggregate reports. You don't get individual reports, okay? And so, you know, I think the safeguards are there that you're concerned about, but I think that would be part of the process of implementation. There would have to be a discussion. So one of the things that we don't want to data mine at all is the narrative self-evaluation on teaching, research, and service, right? That wouldn't be something we would run a report on. That wouldn't exist in the system. So that I think there are elements like that that would be an implementation discussion as we agreed to move forward, all right? And there would have to be, you know, agreements as to what could be reported on and what couldn't be.
And I would remind everyone, the last time this came up several years ago, the feeling among the faculty, and particularly the Faculty Affairs Committee that spent a lot of time on this, was that an electronic system was desirable, that it could really benefit both the faculty and the university as a whole if we could find one that worked and had the right safeguards in it and was functional for the different purposes. And that's why I'm bringing up the question of what the purposes are and what some of the constraints and criteria are. So, did I see someone wants to discuss? Go ahead, Sukumar.
One, would it be possible to get a copy of the presentation beforehand before we come to the meeting so that we know what they're going to present?
Oh, so you mean like of their PowerPoints? Absolutely.
One copy, PowerPoint, whatever is possible.
Sure. That's easy.
Yes. Are we kind of past the point of voting on whether we want this to happen or not? Like, it's going to happen. It's going to computerized method no matter what.
No, but if you have an objection or a reluctance to that, it would be good to know what point exactly you're focusing on, because it's not clear that, for example, a blanket objection to an electronic system actually would apply to all systems, or is it some element of the system that you're looking at that you object to? So I'd like to be specific about what exactly we're talking about.
Okay. So I think that maybe along with looking at what the systems are, it'd be good to know, as you mentioned, what are the benefits overall of going to an electronic system?
Yes, and there would be. Do you want to address that?
The key benefit is right now you're asked to submit an activities report in a Word document, right? Mm-hmm. And you're submitting that electronically. That's the requirement now, right? Mm-hmm. So electronic transmission really is not the issue, I think. It's how will the information be used and who will have use of it, right?
Well, it's the benefit of changing what we're already doing. As you mentioned, we're already doing electronically, so
yep.
Why change it if there isn't going to be a benefit?
Yeah, it's the redundant request for information and not having to go into, you know, 678 Word files and pull information out. That's really the bottom line.
Another benefit.
It would make reporting, you know, I want a report of all the publications that occurred out of all of these this year. And it would come up.
Yeah, and it would be good to see a demonstration of
But from the point of view of the faculty member, the other benefit is that you yourself can use this database as a way to pull out information on your own record. So I know that John Dean has been playing around with potential for this sort of reporting, but you can generate CVs. You can generate trends in your own records. So it can be actually of benefit to the faculty as well as the administration. Ideally, we would be setting up a system where you enter information once and never have to enter it again.
Right.
And, yeah, sounds good. Some of these systems also have means of linking to external databases like the Web of Science and pulling publication information from those without you having to enter everything. So that is an additional efficiency for faculty. So there are some benefits to, and I hope, benefits that actually reduce the amount of work that faculty have to put into setting up their annual activity reports and filing these things. Yes, Laura.
If I remember that correctly, the main issue last time was the formatting, and that essentially to bring it into this format would be a substantial amount of work. And I think that concern is still there, at least for me, because right now I just have to copy and paste it. And if we go to another format, then all of a sudden my activities report that has already taken way too long is taking even longer.
The new revisions, and maybe John and Ken can speak to that, but the copy-paste works quite well in these as well, so the process would be similar. But there's a lot of things. For instance, on the publication thing, your publication would actually be hyperlinked, so somebody looking at it could click on it and actually bring up the publication,
all right?
Would feed into an electronic CV if you wanted it online. So a lot of different uses. It's not as clunky as it was, and that was one of the real concerns, all right? So there is more copy-paste, and this business of being able to download from the Web of Science, huge change. Save a lot of re-entry.
Can I also just point out that there is a world of difference between submitting a static document electronically, we can send them back and forth to each other, and submitting something that can then we can then go back and pull data out from it, manipulate it, move it in, present it in different formats for different reports. So those are very different kinds of activities.
Sorry, yeah.
Okay, one more thing. And so this entire information about our courses, how many people are in there, is immediately linked straight to it, or do I still have to enter that?
That would be loaded from Banner.
Well, that would be good. That's a definite advantage, I think.
Well, it has pros and cons.
Yeah,
it's only as good as the information entered into Banner.
That was true of the earlier version of Digital Methods also, and we found that Banner was putting incorrect data into the... So there has to be a quality control measure somehow, or a way of correcting, at least.
Yep.
John.
Yeah, a couple other nice features.
You might want to use the mic, John.
Yeah, John, come on. Okay. We have some people online.
A couple other of the nice features of the of both of the programs that were the finalists were when you it's accessible to the faculty member 365 days a year. So if you have a publication that's come out, you can just enter it then. Although few of us will probably do that, we're probably going to do it at the end. But for those of us who do, you can just tick a box and that publication will automatically update your web page. And you can decide what portions of what's on there is going to go to your web page or not. And that'll help you keep things a little more active for looking for more students. One of the other big advantages is it'll create a variety of reports, things like short bios and CVs that are fitting various funding agencies' requirements. And then the last thing that we're hoping to use it for is a way to help with Banner entries, particularly for grants. One of our big problems right now in Banner is that if you have a multiple investigator grant, it's the principal investigator only that is listed in our system, and co-investigators, even if they have a large amount of money in that grant, are not necessarily listed there. This is an opportunity for us to double check. So as a co-investigator on a proposal, if you were to enter that into your annual activities report and that doesn't agree with what it says in the Banner, that could send a series of flags and we could gradually update Banner. And that'll be a very long process, but we have to sort of start somewhere.
yes, it'll be a challenge to change these things, and at first it'll probably take more time than it will save. It's just like buying a new computer system or something. But I think overall, either the products are good. So,
Dave, thank you, John.
So I just looked at the digital measures just for grin. It also offers a big part of what it offers is course evaluations. Will we be essentially adopting that as well as part of this move, or is that a completely separate issue?
Separate issue. I mean, it's a choice. We don't have to adopt it, but we can.
Yes, just.
So it seemed like last time there was an attempt to test the system, and when it was tested, then it was revealed that it took like 5 to 10 times as long as doing a normal activities report, and that was one of the reasons why the faculty weren't happy with it. So will there be an opportunity to test this before it becomes the law of the land?
We would certainly like that. You know, it's up to the vendors as to whether they'll allow us to do that, of course.
Yeah, we would have to get the permission to try it in a trial way before purchase from the vendors if that was going to apply. We were also thinking of a phased implementation where, you know, first year it would probably be voluntary and one could still choose to submit Word files, and then the second year would become mandatory. Laura?
Is there going to be a workload adjustment? So have people talked to the deans and so on about adding this maybe to workload? I mean, if this is substantially taking longer, at least for the first time implementing it, I think that would be at least one way of making the sour grapes less sour.
Well, it's not clear that it would take longer, and that would be a discussion that we could have with our deans about whether and how to accommodate this if it takes longer. But I think until we actually select a system and try it once or twice, it's not clear whether it's going to take longer or shorter.
I'd really like to hear from Ken and John in particular talk about their favorites, just so you've heard some of their comments about them.
I personally think either one of the two would work. The one, the data 180, or faculty 180, the one concern I have on that, it's only got 5 employees. Something happens to the CEO of the firm, for instance, what's going to happen to the rest of it? The other one, you know, the Activity Insight, a lot bigger organization going on. I read between the lines a lot. When you look at who's adopted it, you got a lot of the big players involved, Ivy League schools, USC, people that could have acquired whatever they wanted to, and they chose to use this one. I think there's a lot more institutional support that you would have with the second one. My concerns are not with the implementation of this. I think either one of them would be implemented. As far as us putting everything into the package would be fine. My concerns are more macro level. Something that bothers me about having a faculty workload or faculty assessment document is totally designed to evaluate faculty be taken over by an administrative concern. And I think that's something that we have to be careful of, is that I guess I'm looking at, I'm afraid that this thing could turn into a numbers game or promote a numbers game. We are more like a private school than a big school that turns on numbers. And I think one of our strengths is in the personal interactions we've got with our students, with the qualitative side of everything. And that's one of the things I really like about the current activity report that I think could be lost with this one. You know, the third column on an activity report is so vital to understanding what the professor is actually doing. You have a lot of line items, but it's the third one where you get to convey exactly what's going on, what contributions have you made. And while, from what I believe, it could be added to the report like that, either one of these two, it's a use. It's kind of like when you have a 60% kickback in tuition. That affected behavioral. It had behavioral modification effects on how courses are taught, the drive for student enrollments. And that's a concern I have on this one. You have the usual concerns about whether who's going to have access to personnel records, basically, that kind of thing. But I think that, you know, that should be able to be overcome with safeguards in there. But it's really the behavioral implications that this would have. Would it drive us to a numbers university and take us away from our strength of being really quality interaction with our students? It's more a macro concern. The implementation of either one of these two, I think, would work fine.
Laura.
Of the folks that have played with this program, was there a map agent part of this? So does it work for every type of faculty that we have?
One of the questions that both of you were raising, if you decide to look at these products, one of the things you want to look very closely at is the mechanism for customization. And the two companies approach that in very different ways. I've got some immediate reactions to it, but it's much more important how you look at it. How, to what extent and how readily can we customize it for our very different kinds of units? That's a really important question.
So to answer your question specifically, we did look carefully at the service component and to see how that could be customized. And customization doesn't necessarily mean increased cost. I want to make sure that you understand that. In fact, one of the vendors, and I won't speak to who, but one of them, we asked, on a publication, could we have a little check mark as to whether an undergraduate was involved or a graduate student was involved? And they did it live while we sat there. Pretty powerful. Right? So in looking at the service stuff, we know that, you know, between MAP and CES and some of the other units, we have a very, you know, because of our land grant, sea grant status, we have a heavy role there, and we want to make sure they had some of that from other institutions. You know, they had impact statements entered. They had, you know, so yes, the basic stuff is there. Would make reporting for USDA that we're required to do as a land grant easier.
Maybe one of the other things just worth mentioning quickly is that both of the companies produced bids based on the number of faculty and the number of units that are involved. And we told them very candidly that our units have very different interests. They want to present their information in very different ways. So that was a part of their cost structure, and they're aware that there will be those differences.
One important element for all of you to hear that are in specialized accredited units, each of them have pieces that are automatically implemented if you're an ABET school, if you're an NCATE school, if you're an AACSB, like our School of Management, you know, very specific additional things that come into play that make reporting to specialized accreditation easier as well.
Yes.
So prices on the back, are those just for UAS? So this isn't going to be a UA system thing.
That's right.
Just for UAS.
And I would say the digital measures one, the conversation there was they said if you could get any of these units to combine, we could reduce your price estimate substantially. And we said, well, we want you to bid it exactly like this, that listed each institute separately, that listed each college and school separately, listed CES separately, the library separately. You get the idea. So I believe that we could get a better price there for that one. This is kind of the worst possible scenario.
Karen.
We have a general.
My concern, having attended one of these, and just one, but and having talked to people, and I know Ken and I talked about this in a very brief amount, was how to accommodate within these two systems, creative arts, creative writing, performing arts. I didn't get a sense that this was accommodating in any way to that, and I was wondering if you may be able to speak to that so that we don't get marginalized and, you know, when we go for a tenure and promotion and all these things that, you know, just because it's a numbers game, if that's what we choose to play, that, you know, what we do is significant in our function at the university, that's not marginalized just because we're not published in a journal.
Absolutely. So my take on this is if we cannot get so that the same kind of reporting that we have now can occur, we're not going to go there. We have to have the same inclusive nature of it. That was demonstrated in at least one of them. So, because certainly, you know, you look at digital measures, I guess there's the perspective. Digital Measures represents about 300 institutions nationwide. Data 180 represents on the order of 50 to 60. All right? And they have land grant schools, they have research schools, they have small liberal arts schools. So they're all going to have the same collection of things that we have, like fine and performing arts.
Okay, quickly, Ken, we need to...
If I can go back to the cost aspect, I don't think that's a concern of ours. Any cost that we incur should be more than covered by cost savings from... You take one admin assistant plus benefits, you're probably going to be saving multiple admin assistants with full implementation of something like this. And so I think the cost savings would far exceed any cost of paying for a product like this.
We'll take that as a volunteer from the School of Management for the cost savings there.
It's an unfunded cost right now. All right, we need to move on in the agenda, but first I'd like to get a sense of what people think about this. The question is, would you be interested in seeing extensive presentations on each of these two options? And, okay, first let's get an idea of that. Could I have a show of hands?
But these are our choices, these two.
These two are the choices.
The options.
There are no other existing software sets that
there's no
offer a C option. Yeah, well, if you see one that we've overlooked.
Software a few years until there's another option out there or something like that.
Well, we can turn down both of these.
Yeah.
Okay, but these are the two on offer right now. Okay.
Can I ask another question? Mm-hmm. Would there also be presentations about who's going to use these, how they're going to be used, all of those details that were raised today? Once we decide, or if we decide to implement one of these, someone is going to be using them to generate reports. I'd be interested in knowing who is being proposed to generate those reports, what kind of reports.
Sure. I think that's the continuation implementation conversation, and the Faculty Senate would have to be engaged in that.
But it may not be part of these two presentations because these would be done by the companies.
Oh.
And that would be our chance to ask questions of the companies. Yeah, Stephen.
Am I assuming that when you're asking if we're interested in seeing presentations, of course, but could those presentations be open to people who are outside the Faculty Senate?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. And the reason for bringing the Faculty Senate into this is that you all represent your schools and colleges. And so you really are the top candidates to be looking at the details of these packages because it's going to affect everyone you represent. But certainly anyone else who's interested should be involved.
Some others may have more technical acuity.
All right, so let's have a show of hands of people who would be interested in coming to these presentations. Nearly everyone. Okay, very good. Online, do you have the same reaction, or are you hesitant?
I support it. This is Diane and KUC.
I saw a hand go up on the screen.
Yeah, I think Mike and Todd were going to say something.
Yeah.
Okay, I think that's a yes from them, at least from one of them. All right, so let's go ahead and try to schedule this and coordinate it with the Faculty Senate members so that we can at least get them involved and anyone else who's interested.
Yes, agreed to that.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Moving on, governance reports. From staff counsel, Pip Sveezy was not able to be here today, but she sent a bulleted list of items that the staff counsel is working on. Two of those will be of interest to you all. The first is that staff council recently passed a motion requesting the University of Alaska re-examine current geographic differentials in light of more recent cost of living surveys. And this action will be formally presented to Staff Alliance in March. And the other is that the council is setting up for the 2012 Staff Appreciation Day, which is scheduled for Wednesday, May 16th. They have an ad hoc committee to work on this. So that's the communication from staff counsel. The next is ASUAF. Robert Kinnard, you are in the audience. Would you like to speak to the Faculty Senate? And Mary is here. Great.
Hello.
So our apologies for not being able to be here at the last meeting. I heard the office manager gave a report, so that's good. And then I read the minutes, and you guys asked for a report on how our trip to Juneau went. And I think it went very well. We got a lot of positive comments. What we talked about was we were basically meeting with as many legislators as possible. We had a group of about 25 to 30 students from all over the state, from every MAU, and I think we had maybe most of the campuses and satellite campuses represented, including Bethel, which was really cool. We mostly focused on the, there's about roughly $6 million in the operating budget that the governor's office cut when he presented his budget to the legislature, and that included a lot of things that are really important for the students, like initiatives for improved graduation rates and the 2+2 veterinarian program. And so we went down there and we were advocating for that to be put back in with a lot of legislators. We also talked about needs-based and merit-based scholarships that the governor has put together. He's mostly responsible for the merit-based, but we advocated for that as well as deferred maintenance in all the campuses. Our speaker of the coalition and the speaker pro tem spoke in front of the House Finance Subcommittee that deals with the university. And that was a unique opportunity that hasn't happened since I've been involved in student government, so that was pretty cool. And Representative Faircloth seemed very receptive to their testimony. And she has actually, I think she's proposing some amendments probably in the Finance Committee that will be coming up. And so because of that, we are the student government is rallying some students to testify at the House Finance Committee. That there's a testimony is being taken on Wednesday, and so we're going to have a bunch of students go down to the Legislative Information Office and testify there for that. So, in addition, Robert and I and three other students, including the Government Relations Director at ASUAF, are going to go back down to Juneau during spring break, and we're going to kind of do a follow-up trip to what we did in February. And then besides, on a different topic, the student listening session for UAS happened on Valentine's Day, same as the faculty one. And I think it went pretty well. I bought a lot of pizza to try and get students to go, because you can usually lure students with food, but we got some turnout, but it was more about the quality of the students, and I think they had some really good comments for Chad St. George, so that was successful, I'd say. And then other than that, we're working on, there's a proposition to reduce the size of the Senate. Currently we have 20 members on our Senate, and we're trying to reduce it to either 14 or 16, we're kind of in disagreement about that, so just to create contested elections so we don't have people running unopposed. And the elections are going to be during Spring Fest at the end of April, I think. Any questions? Oh, and one more thing, sorry. We actually are increasing our student outreach. We have a new senator who's also a resident assistant, and he created a really cool open house sort of thing. So a lot of ASUAF representatives went to an open house last Thursday night, and we kind of sat there and bought lots of pizza again, because it usually works really well, and we kind of just gave it an opportunity for students to come in and out, give their comments, and ask us questions. So we're going to be working more on things like that as well. So.
Any questions? All right, thank you, Lori.
Thank you.
Good to have the report. Next, UNAC, Melanie Arthur, do you have any comments?
I do. I got a couple of things. You already heard from Chancellor Rogers about the progress in the ORP settlement. I don't remember if he mentioned that, or I guess I could just say that the last time I spoke to you, there were two hurdles that needed to get passed, that the class members needed to agree to the settlement, and then it needed to be funded. So the class members have agreed to the settlement now. It's final in the court, but it's got to be funded. If it's funded through the legislature, then I guess the payout comes in the summer for the class members. The representative assembly nomination process, which I also mentioned last time I was here, is now underway. If you're interested in running for representative assembly, You need to collect 20 signatures from full members on a handy form that was circulated to all faculty, and submit it by March 13th at 5 p.m. to the Elections Committee. The instructions are on the form if you're interested. Right now, the Joint Healthcare Committee is right in the midst of wrestling with the employee rates for next year. That's the payroll deduction that you pay for your health insurance. That's made on a projected basis, so they project both what's going to happen in the year we're currently in financially and then what they expect to happen next year and figure out how much to charge. We're in the very weird situation of the, according to the updated projections, the university is going to save about $5.5 million this year compared to their original projection based on the changes in the deductibles that happened last year. But at the same time, the employees are running a $3.5 million deficit, and we're debating, we're meeting again on Wednesday, what to do. Because that deficit, that's underpayment for the health care that's currently being received in this fiscal year. And one of the questions that we're dealing with is how much of that to pay immediately in the next fiscal year. I can explain the arcane details in some other forum of how that's all how those conclusions are come to, because it's very strange to have at the same time the university is saving a lot of money, the employees are owing a bunch. But it has to do with the CBA and the 83-17% split of the costs, and that when you raise the deductibles, you just take them right off the table. They don't show up anymore in the costs. So the employees took on a lot of costs that aren't showing up in the accounting. The bottom line, whatever administration decides to do, is that your health care rates are either going to go up a lot or they're going to go up an outrageous amount starting in July. Those are the choices that the Joint Health Care Committee is trying to choose between right now. We'll be having, on a related topic, we'll be having a general membership meeting for United Academics here at UAF on March 26th at 3:30 in Greening 408. On the topic of healthcare, we had on our agenda to talk about preventive care, because that's one of the things that we've been getting some feedback that people are struggling with how to get that benefit in the way that they understand that they ought to. But I suspect we'll also be talking about the employee rates at that meeting as well. So that's March 26th, which is a Monday at 3:30 in Greening 408.
Thank you. Any questions for Melanie? All right. Report from UAFT, Jane.
I just want to mention that after Melanie's report, that just to say that the Joint Healthcare Committee is only advisory, so we'll make recommendations, but we really have nothing to hold them to.
Is the Joint Healthcare Committee more or less unanimous or running a good consensus on topics, or are there wildly different viewpoints on the committee? I ask this because the committee is made of faculty, staff. I mean, it's a broad-based committee.
I will say that the unions, there's four unions on the committee, and we're fairly much in agreement. And I can't really speak for the others at this time. I don't really know. You know, where people. I mean, we've just been receiving the information, and you know, We didn't get everything we had asked for at our meetings. We had two-day meetings last Thursday and Friday, and so that's why we have to meet again. This week we're still waiting for more information.
And we are still waiting for more information.
We are.
It hasn't come out yet. On the subject of the rate setting, which is a pretty heavy question, I don't think it's clear yet whether there's real dissension on the committee. There's not a lot of good choices. I mean, the cost has to be paid by somebody, and so we wrestle with, you know, how much. But so there's not so much to argue about in that particular question. All right. Any other questions or comments? All right. That concludes the governance report. The next topic is members' comments, questions, announcements, and I will start off with an announcement. The nominations are open for Outstanding Senator of the Year Award. And for those, we ask you to, Jane, is this right? We're going to send an email to you if you wish to nominate someone for that award. We also will need two or three volunteers to serve on the committee that evaluates the awards and selects the winner. So if you are interested in volunteering for that committee, again, please send an email to the Faculty Senate office saying that you are interested in participating in the committee. So that's two things. That's the committee that evaluates the nominations, and we're also open for nominations. Any questions? All right, and what's the timeline on decisions for this? Are these decided in April or May?
The decision is usually made by the end of March.
All right.
So the committee would make their choice right about the next administration.
All right, so we need to be moving on this rather quickly. Decisions within the next month. Thank you. Any questions or comments on that? All right. Does anyone else have an announcement or a comment or a question for the group?
I have a question or comment, and this has to do with the student grade appeals policy. The student grade appeals policy, I'm not sure if anybody's looking at this right now, but as it's constructed, it's very clunky. Very poorly conceived and very unsatisfying for the student, especially as the way it's conceived. And I think it ought to be re-looked at. Specifically, what happens is that once the student cannot resolve it, it goes to the dean, whose only job is to appoint a committee. And I call on all of you to be on committees, and it's time-consuming. And the student appeal generally is not well-crafted. It's generally not well thought out. And I think we should be able to look at that process to see if there's a better way to handle appeals for students that would make them better aware of the process and better aware of their rights and responsibilities. And so I'm not sure who should be looking at that, but it's something that is a concern of mine, especially since we're trying to turn these things around very quickly so that we can get students into the correct classes and getting through prerequisites quickly.
That is something that the administrative committee can discuss, and then we'll decide where to go from there. Who we should hand that off to. We would need to get some solid information about how many students, whether we can get any feedback from students who have gone through it, and from the faculty and the deans who have been involved. So, yes, we can certainly look into that.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
I was going to speak to this as part of my committee report, but the SATA committee met with the Veterans Service Office, I think is the name of their office, and they would like us to host probably a brown bag lunch where we have a conversation amongst faculty and returning veterans about issues that veterans face, such as PTSD and traumatic brain injury. So how do you work with these students in the classroom? So we're in the process of putting that together. I think the second week in April was what looked good to us.
Anyone else? Linda, go ahead.
Linda from the Advising Center. I was going to bring this up next month, but I think I'll just give you a heads up. There is a Banner student group working on developing an advising appointment and notes program in UA Online that may be going live later in the month. And so as we get more information about it, been quite heavily involved the last few months getting this put together, we've been together some trainings. The key thing, though, is that faculty who want to use this program on UA Online will need to have FERPA certification through the online FERPA program through distance at the statewide address. and then we'll be providing some training for you. So just to give you a heads up that this is coming down the pike. It'll be a great program where you can enter your notes, and students will not be able to see the notes as they can on degree works, but students will, you know, certainly be able to ask for advising notes. And so we're going to have some examples of what kind of notes to put in, what kinds of notes not to put in for this upcoming program.
All right, we can stay tuned for...
Yeah, what's the point of writing nasty comments about students if they can't see it?
It's like Dragnet. You just write down the facts.
All right, let's move on to committee reports from the chair. Reiner, do you have any further comments on curricular affairs?
No.
Andrew Metzger is not here. Does anyone else want to speak for faculty affairs? No. Okay. Unit criteria. Perry, were you on the phone? Maybe not.
He was.
Okay. Jane, Committee on the Status of Women. Any comments? No. All right. Core review. Is Latrice here? Anyone else want to say anything about that committee? All right. Curriculum review.
Yes. As of this academic year, we have dealt with approximately 120 new and changed course and degree requests. Much of this is due to the time, energy, and organizational skills of Jane Harvey. Other unsung heroes are the chairs of the individual college/school curricular committees. If you know who your chairperson is, thank that person. They do a tremendous job, and they put a lot of work into this. If you don't, find out.
Yeah, I find it remarkable how efficient this system has become, how everybody is doing really well in it. So applause for curriculum review as well. Faculty development, assessment, and improvement.
I have nothing to add to this one.
All right. GAC, all right.
I'd definitely like to echo Rainer's congratulations to Jane for actually getting all the paperwork through. We had another 36 courses and, you know, at least twice that many updates to those, and she does a remarkable job of keeping the paperwork organized. Speaking of electronic versions of things that are currently paper processes, making an electronic version of the course changes would be a really, really nice thing. I mean, at least for Jane's workload, certainly for my workload, as the chair of curriculum review committees at all the levels across the college, this is definitely something that just takes a lot of signing paperwork and sending it around, which doesn't really, I think, contribute to the process. And having an email that says, here's an updated curriculum item, check it off here, would be a much more efficient way to get those things done. Probably extremely controversial.
To put it in electronic form?
It's going to be the same set of issues as getting the annual activity reports. But they'll start off electronic, but then from there, it's all different.
I would just add that we could build an on-base workflow that would make that work for you. So, and we're already storing a copy of these documents in on-base, so that's something that we could explore over the next year.
Perhaps there should be a background discussion on that?
I think we could have one, yeah.
How about a syllabus generating one that actually puts all these things in there so that we don't have to, okay, you have the wrong number again and so on. So something like that I think might be useful too. I mean, we're talking electronic. Because there are certain boilerplate things that need to be in every syllabus anyway, so you might as well have those already in there.
Any other comments on this? Okay, Cindy, SATA committee?
Just one more thing. We met last week, and we're currently looking at data that's been generated by different members of our committee. So, for example, the developmental ed department is going through a NAED certification. We're looking at some of that data. We're looking at student success data and just trying to get a handle on what's happening with our students, and we'll probably be generating some initiatives and further questions from that.
Good. Love data. And Research Advisory Committee. Peter.
Nothing more valuable.
All right. And there are numerous attachments from these committees on their recent meetings, so everyone please take a look at those. Any other comments? Then shall we adjourn the meeting? Do I hear a motion?
Moved.
All right, meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.